Welcome to the Parliamentary Podcast Series, Partnering for Global Impact, presented by the Parliamentary Network on the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. The podcast is brought to you in partnership with the parliamentary engagement teams of the World Bank and IMF. Join us as we engage in discussions with leading development experts and parliamentarians from around the world. Together, we'll explore how we can take decisive action to achieve a world free of poverty on a livable planet.
This is Sven Clément, a Member of Parliament from Luxembourg and board member of the Parliamentary Network on the World Bank and the IMF. And I'm today joined by Sibeso Sefolo, a member from Zambia, who is also a member of the steering committee on the Global Young MP Initiative, a network of young MPs here at the World Bank and the IMF. And I'm really happy to be able to discuss with you how we can advance job creation as MPs. Maybe I just wanted to start with you, given that you have a background as an entrepreneur as well, similar to mine, to simply listen to you how we can use the resources of the World Bank and the IMF to support and strengthen SMEs in our regions.
Thank you so very much, Sven, for having me. I'm a parliamentarian from Zambia and also an entrepreneur before I came into public service. And how can we position ourselves as youths to make sure that we can benefit from the IMF and World Bank, making sure that we can create job opportunities in our various countries? First of all, I think that there should be a platform where young entrepreneurs should be able to access grants, access loans that they can repay, and also capacity building. So these things should just not be given to the young entrepreneurs without any capacity building. In Zambia, for example, right now, we have what we call the Constituency Development Fund. And through that, the government has made that provision for youths to have access to funding through the Constituency Development Fund. But I think there's a lot of capacitation that we have to do, just make sure that our youths are capacitated so they can not just create jobs for themselves, but for other youths as well.
I clearly see the need for digital platforms, making it easier to access grants. Because when I first launched my first company, I was flabbergasted by the number of opportunities that existed, but it was almost impossible for somebody who is not in the system to understand that those opportunities exist. So maybe from your experience as an MP now more, how can we make it easier for young people when they launch their enterprise to understand which grants they can apply to? Should there be an automatism? Should we push more information towards them? Or is it more something where you expect them to be self-service and find the information when they need it?
I think we should not have a one-size-fits-all when it comes to information dissemination. We need to understand also that the way information is communicated in a developed country, and for example, in an area like mine that is very, very rural, is different. Here, a lot of systems, for example, are very, very automated, and it's easy for someone to go there and navigate through, surf through, and find the information. But when it comes to areas like, for example, in Zambia, we still have a lot of challenges, even in regards to internet penetration. That means that for you to be able to communicate information, for the information to get to that Zambian out there in the rural setup that needs these grants, we need to communicate information in a manner that they will understand. So there should not be a one-size-fits-all. We should look at the areas that we are targeting. We should be able to segment, for example, Africa. We should be able to segment looking at the areas that we are looking at. How developed are they? Do they have internet? Do they have internet connection? But right now, the government, for example, in my country is very, very committed to making sure that we can go e. There is an e-bus that is happening, but there's a lot that we also have to play as young parliamentarians to making sure that that information is disseminated to the people that we represent. And remember that, for example, Zambia, 68% of our population is actually very youthful. So it's a combination of both, making sure that people access information in a way that they understand it, but also us as leaders, making sure that information dissemination happens.
I really like how you explain Zambia's situation with 68% of people under the age of, I think, 45, which is quite youngish, and we both are members of the Global Young MP Initiative of MPs under 45, looking at exactly those issues. And it's crucial, in my opinion, that we need to find ways to adapt our messaging to the people in need, to not try to have one system that works well in the developed world, but then breaks down the first moment it gets into contact with lower income countries or even middle income countries. In Luxembourg, 99% of the businesses are SMEs, so small to medium enterprises, and they deliver approximately 70% of the jobs. So I was wondering, especially with Zambia being a country that still knows a lot of informal economy, how is that in Zambia? Do you have statistics to share or numbers on how many jobs are being provided by small companies compared to maybe state enterprises or big companies?
Thank you so very much, Sven. Let me actually begin by saying, globally, 60% of the jobs that we have are provided by the SMEs. That means that SMEs are very, very important for any developing country. That means that they're the backbone when it comes to creation of jobs. Specifically also in Zambia, right now we have a new ministry that was created particularly to look at SMEs, that is the Ministry of Small and Medium Enterprises. And specifically, this ministry is making sure that it's empowering the SMEs with grants and loans so that they can have, and also market access through the ministry and also through the Ministry of Commerce. So we've taken deliberate steps to make sure that we can empower the SMEs. But let's come back to the statistics in regards to job creation in Zambia. Like I've indicated, globally, SMEs account for more than 60% of the jobs that we have. But then in Zambia, we are still grappling with making sure that we can link that SME to a market outside Zambia, because we don't consume everything that we produce. We need the markets out there. So we still have a lot to go. Right now, if my statistics serves me right, I think we are only at 18% when it comes to SMEs. But there's a lot, and there's a lot of potential that the SMEs in Zambia have. We just need to make sure that we cultivate and harness it.
I totally agree with you on the need to be able to address other markets, to be open to the world and to integrate regionally but also globally into a market and be able to benefit from it. I believe that currently with the trade wars looming, we should be talking more about how can we talk to each other than to talk about each other. And I believe quite honestly that we also need to use every tool in our toolbox to make that possible. We mentioned earlier digital tools helping businesses to understand what aid, what grants might be available to them. So I come from an advanced economy. Luxembourg is ranked first in many rankings. But when it comes to access to digital tools, we are not that good. I'm always astonished by the potential of African countries when it comes to delivering specific information to the citizens. I give you a very precise example. In Luxembourg, when you do your tax declaration online, well, it's nothing else than filling in a PDF. And so to help the citizens, we had to create digital tools on the private sector to essentially provide a government service. So I was wondering, how do you balance in Zambia the need for targeting your audience, small enterprises, citizens, with specific digital information or even simply text messages? But I believe everybody has a smartphone nowadays. So how do you balance targeting digital information to your citizens and providing digital services as a country to your citizens?
Thank you so very much, Sven. I wish I could say that everyone has a smartphone in Zambia, but unfortunately that is not the standing as it is. But what the government has done is to make sure that there's what we call Smart Zambia, where government has taken deliberate steps to making sure that we can go everything should be able to be accessed online as a country. Like I've indicated, there's still a lot that needs to be done in that regard. Like I've indicated, our internet penetration only stands at at 47% currently. So there's a lot that still needs to be done to make sure that we can go E. And when it comes to us being able to access those services, for example, in the rural setups, you find that, for example, even internet is not available as it is. So in the urban and the peri-urban areas, yes, there's that is being done. And government has also introduced the e-bus. That means that they are onboarding all the government institutions to make sure that every ministry is digitalized and you're able to go on the internet and make sure that you can access all the information. But like I've indicated, you cannot separate the innovation of entrepreneurs from digital, you know, from them using innovations that are available right now in the digital space. That is very, very important for them to be able to access. But that gap is still existing as it is, and there is still a lot that has to be done for us to be able to bridge that gap.
Well, I'm trying to switch gears slightly because we should not be talking only about digitalization, which is obviously a very important topic at the moment. We spoke here at the meetings also about AI and the risk of replacing workers with AI. We came to the conclusion that mostly rural workers, workers that do menial tasks, are less at risk of being replaced by AI than white-collar workers working in offices. So what you describe obviously shows that AI can be helpful, a tool to help farmers grow more, grow faster, be more self-sufficient, maybe also to find new markets for their goods. So I definitely see a lot of opportunities in developing economies to deploy AI for good, for human good. Shifting gears, in my parliamentary work on the finance and economic committees, we've been developing frameworks to stimulate innovation ecosystems. What legislative initiatives have you taken or your parliament taken when it comes to stimulating job creation? Because let me maybe also rephrase it slightly different. Public procurement policies can be a powerful tool for supporting SMEs, but also bigger companies. And we've implemented measures to make government contracts more accessible to smaller companies. Could or have similar approaches worked in Zambia?
100%, definitely. So let me begin before I actually go and answer your question. Let me just touch also on AI and its use. For example, in the Zambian parliament, we are actually in the process of developing legislature. You know, when something new comes on board, there's that fear that comes with it. But I think this is something that we should be able to embrace and see how it can help us. I remember growing up when we heard about the internet, we were very, very worried about it. But then it turned out to be such an important tool.
And so our grandparents about cassettes and TV. TV and radio.
Exactly.
Probably,
yeah. So we are evolving, and we are also looking forward to making sure that we integrate AI into the work that we do. Coming back to opportunities being created, job creation. Like I indicated earlier, there is what we call the Constituents Development Fund that goes to our constituencies that currently stands at 1.6 million dollars. $1.6 million. And in that $1.6 million, that's a preserve of the locals. All the contracts that are done under that the Constituents Development Fund are a preserve of the locals. What I mean is that we are making sure that apart from just every Zambian having access to contracts at national level, we are actually decentralizing those contracts to the local authorities, making sure that the money goes to the people and they should be able to access also those contracts. But also in regards to job creation, like I've indicated, the Ministry of Small and Medium Enterprises is also strategically situated to making sure that they can do that linkage and also encourage our SMEs to go into small businesses, to go into manufacturing, to go into farming. But also, we've also taken by policy to make sure that, you know, in the mining industry, what is it that we can do? As you are aware, Zambia is a very, very mining country, and so are the other African countries. And we are also aware right now that we are going green. You know, we have now the batteries that are, you know, the batteries for the cars, for the electric cars. How do we make sure that there's those jobs that, you know, we don't export the raw materials in the raw form, but instead we can have manufacturing industries happening in our, country so that we can create jobs. And remember, this job creation is also linked very much to security. If we do not have jobs in our respective countries, we'll come to Luxembourg and look for them.
Well, before coming to Luxembourg, probably they will have to transit through a lot of other African nations. And I totally agree. We have a projection that over the next decade, we'll have about 1.2 billion people that will enter the job market, and only 420 million jobs are projected to be created. So we have a gap of 780 million jobs that need to be created somewhere. And honestly, I don't see how we can do that without more innovation. And you touched on it, and I'm really interested in hearing more and maybe discussing that with you, is that question of how can developing countries keep more of the added value inside of their borders instead of simply becoming a resource exporter. And one prime example where it worked is probably in the past has been Southeast Asia. We've seen Southeast Asia, most countries starting at the same level than most African nations after decolonization, but then quickly shifting gears from mining or extraction heavy industries to manufacturing industries, including adding more and more value to that supply chain, including nowadays research development. So how do you think you can imitate, and I'm not only talking about Zambia now, obviously, I'm talking about the whole African continent, and I'm well aware it's a very complex situation with a lot of nuances.
Yeah.
It's certainly not black and white. How do you imagine catching up, and what can the multilateral institutions like the World Bank, the IMF, but also maybe other multilateral institutions like the WTO do to make that possible?
Thank you so very much, Sven. And I'm very glad that you realize that, you know, Africa, there's a lot of dynamics that are involved. First of all, international corporations are very, very important. And we need to realize that as Africans, the more we do business together, the more we come and make this, corporations between our nations, the better it is for us. The export, as you indicated earlier, in the mining sector has been that we export raw materials. I'll give you an example. For example, in Zambia, or just our neighboring Congo, or these countries in Tanzania, for example, there are so many mineral resources that we have. I had the privilege of going to Tanzania just in the last week, and I was able to see how they've taken a step to making sure that the gold that is produced in Tanzania, there's also value addition that is happening with that. They've created bulk centers where those small and medium scale miners can go and sell. Apart from that, the value addition is being done. You go to Tanzania, you can go and buy a bracelet that has Tanzanite, which is a rare stone that is only found in Tanzania. But then it shouldn't end there. For example, when it comes to battery manufacturing, Congo and Zambia should be able to come together and make sure that the plan for those batteries is done in our respective countries. So I think the solution to this is making sure that we should be able to also trade with each other as African countries, making sure that we can break those barriers that are stopping us from trading together, so that we can, for example, iPhone. One of the biggest users of iPhones is Nigeria. There is no plant that exists in any African countries for iPhone. Every time that we export anything in Africa in its raw form, we're exporting jobs. We're exporting, technology. When you're speaking about the 420 million jobs that will be created, opposed to the 1.2 billion jobs, I'm wondering how many of those jobs will be created in Africa. I can bet you that is a very, very small fraction compared to everything that will be produced globally. So we need to go into the manufacturing. We don't want to see a situation in Zambia where we export maize. No.
And that brings me maybe to the next aspect of job creation, and that's education. When we are talking about high value add in the supply chain, it also means specialization. It means having people that trained for those jobs. It's a different kind of training than for menial jobs. I'm well aware that you can have much more on-the-job training when it comes to executing a construction job. but it's much more complicated to do that the more complex a job gets. So the question is also, how can we as the Global North, but also how can we as multilateral institutions support countries like Zambia in training the next generation to not only create the jobs that are needed to sustain the economy, but also the people that can use those jobs, occupy those jobs, and then grow the economy from there?
Thank you so very much. I think the mistake that we've made is to think that when you're talking about a job, it's only a white-collar job. There are so many jobs that exist also in the informal sector. For example, one of the things that we've been able to do as Zambia is to introduce a kind of skills development for our youths.
Like trade schools.
Trade schools. So what is happening now within the Constraints Development Fund, there is a fund that is a prison for the locals for them to be able to do skills. Not just in building. I'll tell you, Sven, when you look back in history, our forefathers never went to train to scout and do all these things. But I can tell you that the best sculptors came from Africa, despite not having these formal jobs. I can tell you, we saw what happened, for example, to countries in the past where, you know, they had the best sculptors that still exist in museums right where we are at today. So we need to develop those skills in our people. And there's no way that you can have the minerals, but you do not have any school that trains an African how to be a designer. You know, to design these things that we have, we process the minerals, and we should not just end there.
Or why do diamonds get cut only in a few international centers in the Global North instead of close to the mining?
Exactly.
It's something that's always like...
Exactly.
So astonishing me.
Exactly. You know, I joked that, you know, despite Zambia having so much gold, I had never seen a gold piece. So when I went on a trip to Tanzania, I had the privilege of seeing, you know, big pieces of gold. If there's any place that it should be cheaper to actually buy gold, is the places where the gold comes from. But I can tell you 100%, there are people that live just, you know, a stone throw from where the gold mines are, and they've never seen a piece of gold. So also even the refineries, it's also another story. We need to make sure that we can invest in infrastructure or policies that support us. Policies that will make sure that we don't export those jobs. Policies that will make sure that we can, you know, industrialize. Policies that will make sure that we can do the value addition when it comes to our mineral resources.
Coming from Luxembourg and having studied in Germany, I'm well aware about the advantages of having formal trade schools. I strongly believe that it's a format that addresses a lot of the needs of an emerging sector. We need also in the Global North, to be more respectful of menial jobs. We are far too often only looking at white-collar jobs and thinking, oh yeah, this is somebody who went to university, this is somebody who is doing the important job. But if we are looking around us, without people doing trade skills, we'd be living in a very pitiful state because we need everybody, from plumbers to carpenters, to people that plaster walls or simply garden. So I'm well aware of the need for skilled trade labor. And I believe that that's something, and you mentioned it beautifully, that we need to support in creating those jobs, but also in enabling citizens of every country that is concerned of being able to access those jobs. So it's a hen and an egg problem. And so I'm moving slightly back to the international financial institutions like the World Bank or the IMF, because to do that, to implement trade school programs, to implement training programs, to implement programs to support SMEs, countries need to have the fiscal space to do that. And one of the big topics we spoke about the last days was debt sustainability. Given that growing concern of debt sustainability, as parliamentarians, shouldn't we advocate for financing structures that don't overburden the future generations so that we make it actually possible for the next generation to start with a blank slate instead of having to support all the bad decisions from the past?
That's a very good question, Sven. And that is totally true. When it comes to African countries, I think the discussion that we've had in the past week is a question to look at the African countries who have come back and borrowed from the World Bank over and over and over again, but we go back to the same trap. We need to rethink, we need to relook, we need to refocus and see how is it that, you know, we've gone back over and over to borrow from the World Bank and we've remained impoverished. How do we then go back and look at poverty alleviation programs instead of always just being on life support? This is the conversation that we're having in the last week. But this also takes us back to one of the things that I mentioned earlier. You know, if at all, that's the World Bank and the IMF, we also need to be able, for example, when you borrow many African countries, you find that the conditions that are given to African countries is different. So we need to also relook at this. Also, the interest rates that are given, we need to relook at that. I know that there's risk that is involved. But for example, specifically to Zambia, what Zambia has done is they've introduced legislation. Any debt that is contracted by the country has to be passed by Parliament just to be able to provide that oversight to our country. Because, you know, we had the debt burden. I'm sure you are very, very much aware. We had to come back and renegotiate our debt. We had to come back and have the extended credit facility done. But then you're looking at a country that is very, very rich in mineral resources, too struggling because of the debt that we've accumulated. And also remember, I always say the debt that you contract when you're an African country is different because it's contracted in a currency that is different from the currency that you have at home. So the debt is totally different because this debt is contracted in a currency that you do not have at home. Sometimes when currency fluctuations happen, it's also difficult for our countries. And we also have to sit and re-talk and look at this debt and see how we can make it sustainable for the most African countries. So I think we need to re-look at it, rethink, and see how also us as African countries, which country can we learn lessons from in the African sphere, where they came and brought from the World Bank and they were able to move out from borrowing and now they're able to sustain themselves. So that we can then learn the lessons. I think it's high time that, like I've indicated, it's high time that African countries needed to look at manufacturing so that we can also get lessons from the Asian countries. How did they manage to do it? Sometimes you look at it at the same scale in the 1970s, and then 30 years or 40 years later, they've moved to be developed countries, while it remain low-income countries. So it's a...
It is indeed a very critical question to ask yourself, where the paths have diverged and what can be learned from that. Of it is certainly... as I mentioned earlier, training, and we need more international programs to support training and also financing training through grants more than through debt potentially, because that is an investment in the future. Training somebody always helped. And you mentioned earlier the security implications of not creating enough jobs, but also the security implications of not creating the right jobs for the population. Because if people can't sustain themselves at home, they are looking to go elsewhere. First, they move internally, which might yield in multi-ethnic countries already certain conflicts. Then they move across the borders, and they might even risk their lives crossing deserts, crossing seas to go to countries where they perceive to be safer, to have a safe job, or to have at least an opportunity to sustain themselves. So the whole migration pressure has a direct link to job scarcity in their home countries. So it's not charity when we invest in creating more jobs. It's not charity when we invest in training people to do those jobs. It is a self-enlightened self-interest to do that, because it enables us to essentially make sure that the security implications of job scarcity get reduced and we can live all together on a much safer planet. That being said, maybe let's look at the potentials we have to create those jobs, to train those people. And we spoke about what the government can do, what Parliament can do, what the World Bank and the IMF can do. Maybe the last actor we didn't speak about was what can the private sector do and how can we entice the private sector to not only create the jobs, but also to train the people to do the jobs, maybe through company trade schools or similar programs. What's your experience in Zambia?
Very, very important questions, Sven. And, you know, for governments to thrive, you cannot just work alone. You also need to work with the private sector. And when it comes to private sector, I think they account also for a lot of jobs compared to those that are done by the government in most developed countries. And I think that what we've done in Zambia is to encourage investment and also bring the private sector on board. So provided incentives, actually, for them to be wooed to Zambia. So for anyone that is interested to come and invest in Zambia, the environment is thriving, and we are making sure that through cutting of taxes for the private sector investment, we've done that. We've also done policies that are enabling so that we can have these private sector investments. We've also done PPPs where we are also involving the private sector, but we are also joint ventures between private sector and the government. So those also are valuable. So we have all those that we've done just to make sure we can create an environment where the private sector can also thrive.
Something that worked well in the Global North, or at least what is perceived to work well, are business incubators, startup hubs, innovation hubs, where we try to bring brilliant people together in one space, very close to each other, and see the sparks fly, creating new companies, creating new jobs, creating innovation out of thin air. So maybe does Zambia has a success story to tell in the sense of trying to bring businesses or business creators together and start something new?
Totally, 100%. This is something, the innovation that we have, that we are doing. Right now, we are also making sure that we're not only bringing business, but we're also bringing like-minded youths together into a hub where they can try and create and spark these things, innovations. So Zambia is looking into that direction. We have a hub that is based right in Lusaka, where we bring, like-minded people. Like, for example, the youths that have done engineering, for example, we bring them into the hub and so they can be able to create this. And we also, the ones that are in technology, we bring them together, like-minded people. We bring them together so that we see what they're able to create. So we have the hubs that we've created. Right now we have two that are operational in Lusaka, where like-minded people can come. And sometimes you find that because we've created these hubs that exist, you might not realize that, for example, technology and this is linked until those people, those youths are in one space, and you realize actually that their talents can marry and produce something that is great. So those hubs do exist, and we also do it for companies. It doesn't just end at youths that we link together. We are also able to link companies together and try and create an environment where when the joint ventures or when these people meet, they can create something that is better for the country. So right now in Zambia, we have the two hubs, and they are a success story. They are doing really, really well.
That's exactly what you want to hear when you are talking about creating jobs in developing countries. It's to hear about success stories. It's not about theory, it's about what really works on the ground. And I'm really happy that you are able to share a success story, because far too often when we talk about cooperation, we, as the Global North, and I see that quite self-critical, are focusing on sob stories. And I just wanted to share maybe an anecdote from a few weeks back when I was talking to a local NGO in Luxembourg. I was talking to them about fundraising and how they are explaining to their constituents why they are fundraising and how the money is being used in their target countries. And what they told me is, yeah, we are trying not to use pictures of poor kids who are malnourished, who are famished. We are trying to show our successes. And our partners are very happy about that, because they tell us, you are the only ones that respect the dignity of the recipients instead of asking for more and more sob stories and pictures that show people at their worst. We should, in cooperation, show people at their best. And I strongly believe cooperation should enable people to achieve their best outcome. And that means creating jobs locally, where people are born, where they live, where they have their roots, and also to train them to be able to then occupy those jobs and create more wealth for their home country. So I'm really happy to hear about success stories. This should not be about a sob story. This should be about a success story. Maybe one last aspect of this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned earlier, you yourself are an entrepreneur. You launched your own company before entering Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
You told me in private that when you entered Parliament, you had to abandon your company because one of your biggest customers was the government and you are
yes.
not allowed to sell to the government
yes.
anymore.
Yes.
How do you see that experience as a startup founder to a certain extent, having informed your policymaking in Parliament and your views on job creation and SMEs in particular?
So first of all, let me just give just a little background. So this company, me and my husband started it some time back when I was only 24. So we started, we're in the we have a honey company, we have beehives. And we started this company, you know, out of interest because both of us hated sugar. So I hate sugar. And my husband didn't also like sugar. So then we started dealing with honey. And then we just, you know, the process of, you know, honey making.
How often did you get stung?
Quite often. And that is also when you get stung, at least when you're selling honey, people know that it's authentic because at the time they can see that, oh, there are bees that are involved. But anyway, so when I came into Parliament, that means that I could not trade with government anymore. But there are also other partners that use honey. Now that is a consuming product. So there are a lot of other people, including government, that buy our honey without knowing that they're buying it from us. So we've still maintained the jobs that we maintained prior. But then there are a lot of opportunities that also exist outside government. That's one thing that I have to say. And that was a conflict of interest. That means that I could not continue being a member of parliament and also working with the same government and produce and give them this this product. But in the private sector, there's no disturbance whatsoever. And Zambia is land linked. That means that there are so other neighboring countries that are still getting our product because we have neighbors everywhere. So despite me going into parliament, we're still doing as well as we did before, just that we had one of our clients that was not part of it. Of us anymore. But that also, without being done, being a member of parliament, it gives me other opportunities. You know about my honey in Luxembourg. So it opens other opportunities where I can also not just sell in Zambia, but I can also export to other countries. So that has been very, very good. But conflict of interest, we cannot work with the government, but I can work with other governments that exist. And that's also why networking is very, very important and market linkage. So I have clients that have come on board that were not there before.
Oh, that's great to hear. And that links maybe to a last point. You mentioned earlier exporting, and we spoke about free trade. And you mentioned that there are other examples where free trade happens or works well. And then you also spoke about Africa needing to get their act together when it comes to free trade, especially internally of Africa, having manufacturing where it makes sense and then supporting the whole continent.
Mm-hmm.
I come from one of the founding members of the EU. So for me, living in a free trade area that works, a single market with common standards, common market conditions, is pretty normal. I understand that the African Union was founded on the same principles, but has not yet achieved the necessary maturity to impose a single market across the differing nations. When we have similar discussions in the EU, we often say, well, couldn't we do a EU of multiple speeds, where those countries that are moving faster can integrate much closer, and those that are maybe moving slower can take the necessary time to integrate closer. So how do you see the African Union evolving when it comes to enabling job creation and economic opportunities for its member states?
Thank you so very much. Let me say that, you know, the African Union was born out of the same purpose that the EU was, just was to enhance. Now we have the Africa free trade areas that we've signed and make sure that we can trade as African countries, but we need to up our game. We need to collaborate more, and we need to make sure that when you go on the own negotiating table, we remain tight. I say so. I have the privilege of also sitting on the OACPS, which is Organization of Africa, Caribbean and Pacific States, and also in conjunction with the EU. There is never a time that the EU come and negotiate as individual countries when it comes to trading. They make sure that everything that they do, whatever policies that you find in, you know, in any EU countries when it comes to trade, they are the same. We need to move to that. We do that as also African countries, making sure that we don't have, you know, countries that go and negotiate as countries when you have something that you've consolidated as African countries, especially with the EU. So you find that the EU will come as consolidated, but then they will go, for example, and negotiate with Zambia as Zambia. They will go and negotiate with Namibia as Namibia. So we need to make sure that we can tighten you know, the organization that we've created, the EU, so that when it comes to the negotiating table, we are negotiating as one people. And we also need to make sure that we can consolidate our policies. The policies that exist in Zambia should be the same policies that exist in another mining country. That will put us in a better standing for us to be able to deal with our counterparts. Because when they issue those regulations, say they'll say it's the EU. But for example, when you issue certain regulations, you find that it's Zambia on its own. So we need to create leverage our policies so that they are consolidated. And when we stand on one ground, opposed to us having these different policies in these different countries. Because this is one of the things that eats us up. So we need to consolidate our policies in our countries. And also when it comes to taxes that exist.
That's where politicians are exactly. Very icky.
So when it comes to also taxes that exist in our various countries, and also the incentives that we give in our various countries, we need to make sure that those are consolidated. Because, for example, when it comes to mining, for example, the incentive that is given by Zambia will be different from incentive that is given by Zimbabwe when we're just neighbors there. So we should be able to have policies that speak to us as AU, so that when it comes to trading also we speak as one people. But the moment we are divided like that, it makes it difficult actually for us to sit on the negotiating table, because you find that sometimes we have, you know, there's things that are signed outside what we have agreed as African country. So we need to strengthen the AU when it comes to us going on the negotiating table with other multinationals.
I've rarely heard such a flamboyant plaidoyer for multilateral institutions and multilaterally coming together, negotiating common market conditions. And I believe that's what this is about.
Yeah.
Where in the world could a member of parliament from tiny Luxembourg sit next to a member of parliament from Zambia discussing international issues when it comes to cooperation, when it comes to economic cooperation, but also on training, on creating jobs that actually matter, because everything in the world nowadays is interwoven. And so we really need to address those issues with a common voice.
Totally.
We might not agree on the intricacies of policy making. And I believe that's the power of multilateral institutions. And that's also the power of the parliamentary network on the World Bank and the IMF. We come from different backgrounds. We come from different countries. We come from the majority and the opposition. But we meet all together with a common goal on making the world a better place. And I really love that sentiment when we are sitting in those rooms together and we are discussing how we can achieve that. And we mentioned that cross-country knowledge sharing is important, trade is important, but also the knowledge sharing among parliamentarians.
Totally.
Being
totally.
Able to see the world through the eyes of somebody else or walk a mile in the shoes of somebody else is something that is unbelievably powerful. And so I'm really happy that we are both part of these networks and that we're working together on making the world a more livable space. I believe that sustainable and inclusive growth requires both sound economic policies and strong social foundations. Our role as MPs is to ensure these approaches work together. And so maybe as a closing thought, because we are running over time as always, politicians love to speak. As a closing thought, in a world where 1.2 billion people will enter the job market and we don't yet have enough jobs for everybody, don't we need to act now before it's too late?
We needed to act yesterday. Actually, now is even like we have to do it like yesterday. And let me also mention that, you know, we, the youths, need to be also in the driver's seat, because the ones that are going to enter this job market are the youths. We are the ones that are young parliamentarians now. There's nothing that cannot be done for us without our involvement. I always say you can't cut my hair in my absence. So anything that involves me, you know, I have to be there at the table. So it is now, Sven, that we have to look at this job critically, and also in our respective parliaments, make policies that will support that young entrepreneur, make policies that will support, you know, youths coming together, creating hubs, not just in Zambia. I forgot to make mention that the hubs in Zambia also work with the hubs that exist in Rwanda. They have a partnership that they're able to work together. We need to create these spaces where youths can be innovative. Youths can be encouraged to create even more jobs. We also need to encourage the use of AI. Let's not shun away from it, and find the way that we can work with it to create even more jobs for the future generation. So I'm saying that we needed to act like yesterday, but the time to act is now. We need to have that action. Let's make the call to action, and let's call on every loving youth out there globally to come and be part of this. And all the youths that are listening to us and are not yet part of this network, joining the network was yesterday, but you're welcome now.
Thank you, Sibeso Sefolo from Zambia. My name is Sven Clement. I'm a member of parliament from Luxembourg. And this is the podcast series of the Parliamentary Network on the World Bank and the IMF. And next time, I heard there will be somebody else hosting again, and we'll be back for sure talking about the important issues in cooperation and in multilateralism. Thank you very much, and hear you soon.
Thank you for having me.